today's stuff, the two-part shiur on Hilchos Nida. Now, Hilchos Nida is a very large topic in Halacha, and if you'll be in Smicha, so I spend like from the beginning of the year, from September till Pesach, on it with the Talmidim, so twice a week, 1.5 hour shiur, like. Twice a week, you know. So there's a lot to do. Then I learned with Chassanim one-on-one, like 5 sessions. And if any of you, Bez Hashem, getting married and would like to do that, I'd be happy to learn with you as well. So, but for the purpose of this year, we're going to have the highlights of Hilchos Nida in 2 parts. And Bez Hashem, when you get engaged and you want to review it or do more, you can contact me and we can learn more on these inyanim. Because what's interesting about Hilchos Nida is that usually, until you're married, you usually don't know anything about it. It's like Hilchos Shabbos, like, it's a more public thing. So even though before you learn it, you know more about it. Hilchos Nida is a more private thing, so it's not something that's going to readily be discussed so openly, and you're not going to know so much about it until it really is nogea to your own lives. Okay, so what exactly does nida mean? Nida, you have a thing ever done? No. Okay, nida is dam min hamokar. It's the shedding of the lining of the uterus, and the blood comes out of the uterus, and that so the blood that comes out of the uterus is dam nida, and that happens for most regular women on a monthly cycle of having dam coming out of the lining, shedding of the uterus, and that is in the form of blood. And that makes a woman a nida. And the nida is a din d'oraisa, that one is not allowed to have intercourse with a nida. And if he does, he violates an issacharis of having intercourse with a nida. And furthermore, one is not allowed to hug and kiss the nida as well. That's according to the Rambam, you get Malkus for that. And then there are a whole added bunch of restrictions, which we'll talk about in, you know, maybe later today, or etc. So, now, when your wife becomes a Nida, again, as I said, we're not going to be able to cover every last detail, but I'm going to give you some of the important highlights of Nida. So when your wife becomes a Nida, she gets a period, you're going to be forbidden for her for a minimum of 12 days. That means 12 days you have to separate. If you're a Sephardi, it's 11 days. Sephardim Molinit. Ashkenazim, 12 days. And the 12 days are divided into 2 parts. The 5 days of the bleeding, and the 7 days of the clean days. And even if she bleeds only for 1 day, you still have to wait 5 days nonetheless. Because we don't want, when we start at 7 clean days, clean days means that there's no bleeding for 7 days. We also want there should be, that the couple should not have had intercourse for at least 5 days. So this way, there's no semen that's coming out of her body during the 7 clean days. So it's already 5 days that you're usher to her. So then, even if there was beer from before, but anything, any semen was already putrid. And not consequential. So the halach is when your wife gets her period, you're going to be forbidden for her for 12 days. The five bleeding days, and even if it's not real bleeding days, even if she only bled one day, you still have to do 5 and 7. Those are the... and then after the... And after that, then she goes to the mikveh at night, after the 7 clean days, which from the beginning of the period is the after 12 days. Now that's the minimum. But sometimes women bleed even more than 5 days. They can bleed 6 days. So then it's going to have to be 6 and 7. Then you're going to have to separate your wife for 13 days. It could be more, but a minimum. For Sfardim, it's 4 and 7. They wait 4 days and then 7 days. Now, that's only if they could stop bleeding by 4 days. If they're going to bleed into the 5th day, then it's not going to, then it will be the same as the Ashkenazim. But potentially, if they stop bleeding in the 4th day, so the next day they can count the 7 clean days. So that's what's the practice. The practice is that they ask it to your wife for 12 days, the 5 bleeding days and the 7 clean days. Now on the 5th day, she does a bedika. In other words, how do you know the woman stopped bleeding? So there's an obligation of doing a bedika. A bedika means you get a certain cloth, and the woman wraps it around her finger and goes inside, takes it out and sees if there's blood on it. And usually, a lot of times, you have to ask a shayla to know whether the color is a proper color or not proper color. I mean, the women are trained how to do it properly, these bedikas. And the one on the 5th day is called the Hefsek Tara. The Hefsek Tara is the bedika done on the 5th day to ascertain that she stopped bleeding. And then, if she stopped bleeding, then there's another bedika. In other words, the Hefsek Tara is done on the 5th day before Shkia. On the 5th day before Shkia. And after Shkia, she takes another cloth and she just leaves it in for like a half an hour or so and takes it out, and that's like a double check. That's called the moch, to make sure she stopped bleeding. So she does a hefsek tara before Shkia, a moch during Bein HaShmoshos. She leaves it in for a half an hour. And if the hefsek is good, and the moch is good, then she can commence the next day counting the 7 clean days. And during the 7 clean days, she's supposed to wear white underwear. And so this way, if Rabbi Will pointed out, others pointed out that we could see if there's any more staining. It's white, so it's more noticeable. Like some point, well, you have this point down. And that's how someone explained it. We'll get others explained. And then you're supposed to do bedikas 2 days. She had two bedikas a day for a week. And if that's too much, you can do 1 a day. And then if it's all good, then she goes to the mikveh after the 7 days. And she goes to the mikveh at night. Right? And then after she comes back from the mikveh, then she resumes being, her husband's supposed to ask her if she was tovelis, and if she's tovelis, and then they resume being mutter to have physical contact together. Right, so the time to go to the mikveh is at night. That's when usually the mikvehs are not open during the day. Go to the mikveh at night. Now, sometimes it can be very difficult to go to the mikveh at night. For example, this usually comes up. You know, I usually get a phone call a week before Pesach from a man or a woman, and says, you know, the way it looks, that the mikveh night is going to be the night of the Pesach Seder. That's like the worst time. You know, like the whole family's there. So how's the woman going to just excuse herself that she has to go someplace at night for an hour? You know, and everyone's going to know, and she's going to feel embarrassed. So there are poskim that permit in certain, and you need a special heter for this, that is for her to go to mikveh in the daytime, provided she won't see her husband till the night. So in that scenario, it would mean that she would go, say, in the afternoon on Erev Pesach. At the time she comes home, he already went to shul. And the time he comes from shul, it's dark. So in other words, we only permit to go, if, you know, there's a machlok is whether we permit this machlal, but according to the opinions that we permit going to the mikveh in the day and the seventh day, is only when there won't be any chance. See, we're afraid if she goes in the daytime, we're afraid that the couple is going to have intercourse before the night, and then later that day she'll bleed some more, and it turns out that she never had really seven complete days, and she even bled in the seventh day. It turns out, in retrospect, that it wasn't a good day. So therefore, normally we say don't go to the mikveh till nightfall. But some Rabbeinu Tam says, but if she goes in the day and she doesn't see him till night, so there's no problem that they're going to come to have intercourse because they're not going to see each other till night. So normally we say don't go to the mikveh till night. But in certain situations where, you know, I gave you one possible scenario, you know, where there's not going to be any chance that the couple is going to be together, and in a situation where they don't see each other till, in other words, she goes to the mikveh, and while she goes to the mikveh, he goes to shul. So then, when she comes back, he's already in shul. When he comes from shul, it's already dark. So that's the. But this has to. You need a special heter from a rav for this. It has to be arranged with the mikveh. Because a woman is never allowed to go to a mikveh alone. There's always a mikveh lady watching her to make sure that she went under. But no, the Biyuda is a tshuva in a situation where there's no mikveh lady available, so the no, the Biyuda has a kula where he permits the husband to serve as the mikveh lady. In other words, the husband to make sure that she went, you know, because if there's one strand of hair that didn't go under the water, then it's no good. It's not a good feeling. They don't say, oh, you know, she went under, but if there's one strand of hair that didn't go under, it's not a good feeling. So that's why we always want somebody to watch to make sure that everything was submerged in the water. The whole body plus the all the hair as well. Okay, so that's the situation. But normally we say somebody shouldn't go to the mikveh in the daytime because there's a chashash that if you go in the daytime and you come home, you might then right away want to be with your husband, and then later in the day you might bleed. And it turns out that the seventh day was not a real clean day because you only knew that in retrospect. So you already were with your husband, wife, and the husband together, and then retroactively it turned out that the day was not a clean day. So that's why normally you go to the mikveh on Motzai 7 at night. And this Rabbeinu Tam has this kula that if you go in the day, but you make sure that you won't see each other till night, then he would be makel. But again, if anyone is in a difficult situation where they are contemplating of looking for a heter, they have to call up a rav and discuss it, and then the rav very often will have to, if he thinks he deems it legitimate to do so, then he can call up the mikveh lady or whatever and tell them to let her in. Certain communities they will never let, as a policy, they'll never open in the day. In certain communities are more flexible. It depends where you are, but you know, these things. I've had shaylas like this that you know, people are going to, they go to Eretz Yisrael that night, so she can't make it. She goes to mikveh at night, she'll miss her flight. So it's also a discussion, you know. So every situation has to be dealt with, you know, for its own merits and what it is. Okay, let's go over what exactly is usher when your wife is Mita. Okay? So we said before, the two major prohibitions are having intercourse and hugging and kissing. Again, having intercourse is an issacharis, hugging and kissing, according to the Rambam, is an issa malchus, is an issa laf. However, the Chazal and the Rishonim felt necessary that to add added restrictions, because they felt that a husband and wife are together usually, and the natural tendency is for them to cohabit together, be intimate together, etc. And if they felt that we just tell them that you can't, it's going to be difficult for them to observe it. So therefore, they were afraid that people will not observe it. So therefore, they added additional stringencies to make sure that people won't fall in and make a mistake. So we're going to go through, these are called the harchakos. The harchakos. And these are the added stringencies that were put in to make sure that everyone keeps the ikir halal. Okay, so the first thing was that they restricted a husband and wife being in bed together, meaning even if the man is wearing clothing and the woman is wearing clothing, they should not be in bed together. Because obviously if there's going to be in bed together, that's going to lead, that potentially could lead to having more intimacy and intercourse or whatever it could lead to, and therefore they restricted that. Furthermore, they restricted the man sleeping or going, sitting or sleeping, whatever, in his wife's bed, even if she's not there. And the husband shouldn't be in, and she shouldn't be in his bed, etc. Because again, they were afraid if you're going to be in your wife's bed, even if she's not there, that's going to lead you to have, you know, thoughts of intimacy, and ultimately, you know, when she'll show up later, that's going to arouse you. The fact that you were in her bed is going to arouse you to want to have this physical intimacy with her. So they restricted being in her bed, even if she's not there, and she shouldn't be in his bed either. Yeah.
Shouldn't her focus only be on during
the 5 days and 4 days, since it's those the only Doras anyways? Why would they make harchakos there on the Darabanan on the Darabanan, not the 7 days? No, meaning these harchakos apply for all 12 days. In other words, all these restrictions of that we're going to speak about apply the whole 12 days, because if a woman has a period and she didn't go to the mikveh yet, she's still at either deraisa. In other words, you see, the idea is like this. Min HaTorah, the whole din of need is only 7 days. Meaning, Min HaTorah, if a woman bleeds for, say, 4 days, she just has to wait 3 more days and then she can go to the mikveh after that. That's midaraisa. But Chachamim added all these restrictions that it's not enough just to have 7 days, you need 7 clean days. So you don't count the days she bled. And it's not enough just to have those days, you have to have the 5 days before, because we don't want any shefa zera. So the whole requirement, so we don't let her go to the mikveh minimally after 12, till after 12 days. But lemaisa, the fact that she doesn't go to the mikveh, she's still an ida deraisa. Even on day 12, she's an ida deraisa. You know? Hello? You follow?
Yeah.
Okay, so that's the story. Okay, so that's the first thing of not being in bed together, not being in each other's bed. And the Mordechai adds another thing, that the beds have to be separated. The beds have to be separated. They can't be touching. Beds can't be touching each other. Because we're afraid if the beds are touching each other, you're going to be, even though you're in your bed and she's in her bed, but if the beds are touching, that's going to lead also to intimacy. So you have to move the beds apart so they're not touching. And that's why it's best, the easiest thing is if you have two separate beds and two separate bed boards, you just move them apart when she needs it back together, she's not. Because if you have one big bed board and the beds are attached to that one big bed board, so every month it's going to be a whole pain in the neck to have to unscrew it and move it away, you know, one of the beds, so they shouldn't be touching. So this way, if you have two separate beds and two separate bed boards, you just move them apart a little bit. When she's in need, they're back together. When she's not, it's very simple. So that is that requirement as well, to separate the beds. Next is that a man is not supposed to see parts of his wife's body that are normally covered up when she's in the house. In other words, when a woman walks around in the street, so she's more covered up even. But she walks around in her own house, she might be less covered up. So whatever she normally covers up while she's in her own house, that the husband can't see when she's in either. In other words, her chest is covered up, her legs are covered up, her arms are covered up. But say, like if she goes to sleep and takes off her hair covering, when she's not in either, so then Rav Moshe says, so that even when she is in either, the husband can see the hair in privacy, because even though outside she would never uncover it, but since inside she would uncover it, so that's not called makom mechusa. And therefore, you could see that but the parts of her body that are normally covered up when she's in the house, so the husband cannot see when she's in either, for obvious reasons, because we're afraid that if he's going to see those private parts of her body, then that's going to, you know, excite him and cause them to have intimacy. Okay. Furthermore, there can be no physical contact between the husband and the wife during Nida. But even if it's not an endearing way, they just happen to knock into each, you know, in other words, if you do it in an endearing way of hugging and kissing, so that's it's a daraisa. But if they have physical contact, say for example, Rashi says that you can't pass things directly when you're needed. In other words, if you have to give her the keys, you can't just hand it to her. You have to put it down, and she picks it up, and vice versa. And one of the reasons is you might come to touch. Now that's not, when you give someone keys and you happen to touch their hand, that's not endearing. But yet, even that, the Chachamim are afraid that you shouldn't do. So that's part of the Hachakas, that there shouldn't be any passing. And the Ramah quotes that even throwing is awesome. Even to toss her the keys is also as well. And Rabbi Bari told me he thought also that all these games, like tennis and ping pong and all these things, also should not be done. All these games where you're tossing things to each other, get them a frisbee, things like that, should not be done when she's in need.
Okay. All of these added restrictions apply to both the man and the woman, meaning the woman can't touch the man and she can't pass him.
Right. works both ways. Yeah. I mean, certain things are not both ways, and I'll, as we do more, I'll tell you certain things which are not both ways. But certainly everything, about everything we've discussed now is both ways. There is a big discussion about passing a baby. Okay? Because when your wife gives Bezer Shem, when you get married and your wife gives birth, so when a woman gives birth, she's usher to the husband. And usually she's going to be usher to him for a good 5, 6, 7 weeks. They're going to be forbidden for each other. Well, for two reasons. One is, whenever a woman gives birth, there's too much labor. So if you give birth to a girl, the tumas leida is for 14 days. If you give birth to a boy, the tumas leida is for 7 days. So that's, well, okay, but that's only 2 weeks, 1 week. But, and that halacha is, even if no blood came out with the birth itself renders a woman tummy. Even if it's called leida yevesha, even if there was no blood that came out, the fact that the fetus came out, the fact that, so that makes a din tumma. But it happens to be that the reality is that when a woman gives birth, blood comes out also from the uterus, not just the baby. It comes out with blood. And the reality of today's day, that blood, lasts 5, 6, 7 weeks. So when a woman gives birth, she's going to be usher to her husband for, she's not going to stop bleeding for like 5, 6 weeks. And then after she stops bleeding, then she'll do a hefsek tahara and count as the 7 clean days, and then she'll go to the mikvah. Whereas a regular nida, 5 days and then the 7. Here it could be 6 weeks and then the 7 clean days. So it's so what happens a lot is, so she's gonna, is especially newborn, you're gonna wanna pass the baby, because that's what happens with new babies. You need to pass, you need to put it down, whatever. So that's a big shiloh, whether she's a nida, and it's not only that, it's, later on also, when she finally goes to the mikvah, then she gets a period again some other time, she's gonna, so some poskim hold that there shouldn't be any passing of the baby either, and then you'd have to put it down. Rabbi Willie was concerned that people are gonna just do foolish things. Like a keys, so you put that, you're in the parking lot, so you're gonna give your wife your keys, so you can put it on the top of the car and then she'll get it. But chas v'sholem, if someone does that to a baby, rechmona litzlan, something very severe could. So he was afraid of that. So he thought that, technically speaking, you say that a baby is a chola, and if it's a chola, you could just pass directly, even the people who are machmir for this obviously have to do it with seichel and know not to endanger. But people think, just for a second, and then a second, chas v'shalom, something shouldn't happen. So there's room to say that one could be like that, but not everyone agrees to that. That's a machlokas. Yeah.
If a woman had a C-section, is she still forbidden after the birth?
Right. So it's a very excellent question. What's your name again?
David. One flash.
Yeah. So David pointing out that the din of tumas yoledes is only from a vaginal delivery. And if it's a C-section, then you don't have tumas yoledes, but she's still going to bleed. So she's still going to be, in other words, a woman is usher to her husband after birth for two reasons, for the leida and the blood. So even if the leida, so usually the leida doesn't make a difference, because the blood is going to go way past that. It's So you have to wait, say, 2 weeks for a girl, right? But she's going to bleed for another 5 weeks. So in the end, she's going to wait 2 weeks plus. You understand? So it's, in the end, it's not going to, you know, very, you know, very rarely you have a situation where the bleeding stops before the 2 weeks. But the kiddush is, in a situation where it's a regular birth, not a C-section, the woman, and the bleeding, let's say the bleeding would stop before the 2 weeks, you still have to wait 2 weeks before she goes to the mikvah. What happens sometimes is in the case of a miscarriage. So the miscarriage, so if it's a miscarriage, and it was formed to a certain degree, it was after 40 days, and it was formed to a certain degree, so you still have to do tumas nomadis, and usually in a miscarriage you don't know whether there's a boy or a girl, so you have to do 14 days, assuming the worst. Not the worst than being a girl, but the worst that the mochamer did, that it's 2 weeks. And there, by miscarriage, the bleeding is not going to necessarily be as much. So there, sometimes, the bleeding stops before the 2 weeks, so then you have to know that even though the bleeding stopped before the 2 weeks, the 5 and the 7, but still have to wait for the 2 weeks. But even then, a lot of times the bleeding surpasses the 2 weeks anyway.
If the point of the harfakot is to like remind you, like, this is a different time and you shouldn't, it's like a fence run actually doing this with the actual iser, then, like, you said you can't pass something, just like throw something to your wife. If I'm this close to Jesse, if I throw it up in the air, that's not how I normally do it. It's already like a separation from how I do it, instead of handing it to him. Is that like okay? Because you say you can't actually throw something.
Right.
I'm doing it differently though. It's not like I'm throwing. If I was over there and he was over here, I would throw it. But if I was right here, I would hand it to him.
Right. But nonetheless, you know, the Ramah asks throwing. Because throwing is also a certain level of connection between the two of you. And the Ramah says you shouldn't throw things to each other. So. Okay. Now, have we get on to all this? Yeah, we were talking about the hachakas. And then we were talking about. How did I start talking to you about we were talking about the baby. Yeah. Passing the baby. That's how we have it. Okay. So passing, you can't pass things to each other. And perhaps there might be a leniency for the baby, but certainly things like, you know, the keys and the, you want to give a spoon to you, or whatever, so then you don't, you put it down and then she picks it up. Okay. So the next thing is restrictions of eating. The restrictions of eating are the following. You can't eat from the same plate together, because that's considered a level of intimacy that you're eating from the same plate together. Rav Abadi told me, and I think Rav Moshe has something similar, Rav Abadi told me if you're doing it in a way that you'd only do it with a husband and wife. Like, say, for example, you have a bowl of popcorn on the table. So could you and your wife, like, munch from that bowl of popcorn? Or is that considered eating from the same plate? So everybody thought that it would be okay, because lamaisa, a bowl of popcorn you would eat together with a stranger. Like when you come to, like, you know, some type of simcha, is, you know, a bowl of popcorn that everyone's taking. So it's total strangers. So it doesn't show any intimacy, any closeness. But I don't know if, like, you have one serving of mashed potatoes on a plate. I don't know if you would just eat it with some stranger. You would eat it with your wife to show a symbol of closeness. So that you can't do when she's a nida. Okay? Now, that's number one. Number two, you can't eat her leftovers. Say you're eating a meal together and she didn't finish. She has leftovers. So if she's still in the room, you can't eat her leftovers. But, now this is the area where you asked. This doesn't go both ways. She could eat your leftovers, even if you're still in the room. But you can't eat her leftovers. Because the assumption by this halacha is that we assume that the man is more drawn to the woman than the woman is drawn to the man. And we're afraid that if you're going to eat her leftovers, that may cause you to be drawn closer to her and then ultimately do something that's, you know, of the chabritic things. So therefore you can't eat her leftovers when she in her presence, but she could eat yours. If she leaves the room, then you can eat her leftovers. Furthermore, if the two of you are eating at the table and no one else is there, just the two of you, you have to put a heker on the table. I mean, you have to put something on the table between the two of you that normally does not belong on the table. And Rav Avadi points out it should be a certain, like at least a tefach high, so it's noticeable, to remind you that she's an eater. For example, I can stand up a flashlight between the two of you. It's a bottle of Elmer's glue between the two. There's nothing to do, there's not something that's on the table anyway. Something that normally would not be on the table to remind you that she's an eater. Because when you're eating together, that usually brings kinship, or it brings closeness to two people that are eating together, and that you could get carried away, and if you forget she's an eater, then you might do something, you know, of intimacy to her, and therefore, that's okay. So therefore, that's not okay. So therefore, so therefore, you shouldn't do something of intimacy to her, so you have to be reminded, so you put a heker on the table. But that's only if the two of you are alone. If someone else is at the table, then already that's not an intimate setting. And therefore you don't have to put any heker. You just eat regular.
Why didn't
the
Rabbanan just
ask Yichud? Why Rabbanan ask Yichud? So that would be make life very hard. And the only time they ask a yichud by nida is that if a couple got married and they didn't have intercourse yet, either because she was a nida at the wedding or before they got a chance to be intimate, she became a nida. So then the Yetzirah is... See, before the couple is together for the first time, that's when the Yetzirah is the greatest. So therefore, then we're afraid that you're not going to be able to control yourself, so therefore they ask the yichud. But after the couple already was intimate once, so then, so to speak, the Yetzirah is no longer at that level. So that's, as Rav Shechter said, based on the Tosis, so they said that, you know, we trust you that you won't violate it. And that's the Gemara says in Sanhedrin, it's like a suga b'shoshanim, a hedge of roses, and no one's going to breach the hedge of roses. In fact, Dr. Norman Lamb wrote a book on the Shkafa of Nida, and he called it Hedge of Roses, based on this, you know, pasuk in Shir HaShirim, with the Gemara commenting on that. But, you know, if they would ask it, then, you know, that would make, you know, that would make life very, very difficult. Because they were like a young married couple, so what would they do? Every time his wife's in need, they'd have to stay in a different apartment? leave the door unlocked overnight, and it would be, you know. But if the halacha would require it, then that's what we would do. But the halacha doesn't require it. The only time the halacha requires it is in this case of a chuppas nida. And, you know, we try very hard to avoid a chuppas nida. But every once in a while it happens that there's a chuppas nida, and then we have to work around it. The most cool shita about that for the chuppas nida, by the way, of Nissen Karel says, and I've heard from Rav Amadi, is that you would have the couple. See, technically, the Gemara says that he has to sleep with the men and she has to sleep with the women, that they're totally separate. So, what people are more making was manazer, like some hold of Nissen Karel from Amadi, is that they spend the night with another married couple who they're friendly enough to confide in, that's what happened, and they stay on the same floor, and this couple who's just got married leaves their door open, and there's another couple on the floor who could barge in at any moment, and the door is open, and that is one type of hanhaga that's used. And that's enough to be matter the yufid. That's a cool, you know, just to allow that, you know. But regular nida to Chazal didn't ask. Okay. Okay. So that's the. The leftovers, what was the last thing we said? The leftovers, the heker, right, the heker. Now, there is another prohibition of pouring wine and passing wine to each other. That a husband can't pour wine for his wife, a wife can't pour wine for the husband, neither can he send wine to her. So, you know, he can't even put, this issur is even more chumer than the regular passing. Regular passing is only if you give the keys directly to her hands. If you put it down in front of her, that's okay. Here, even if you put it down in front of her, the wine, or she puts it down in front of you, it's still awesome. So the question is, what happens by Kiddush? What do you do for Kiddush when your wife is in need? That's the big question. So there are different ways of dealing with Kiddush. One way of dealing with Kiddush is that you can pour into her cup before she comes in the room. In other words, what some people do is they have plates on everyone's, and then there's a little cup on everyone's plate, and it's already poured, pre-poured before Kiddush. And the husband does that before his wife even comes into the dining room. And that's considered drinking, as Rabbi Body points out, that's considered drinking from Kol Shel Bracha, because it's on the table when you made Kiddush. So, and therefore, you pour it into her cup, not in her presence, so that's permissible. Or another heter is, if there are a couple of people on the table, you could pour in front of everybody into these little cups, but you don't designate which is for your wife. And then everyone just takes whichever one they want. So since it wasn't designated that this is for her, so you can pour even in her presence. Or sometimes she can just pour on her own or take on her own, etc. So that's the story of the wine. Next. There is a... Yeah.
Wine is more mafia in that regard because it intoxicates. So meaning, would it be a problem for grape juice?
Yeah, I mean, grape juice also we consider as like... would be considered like that. Some people, some poskim are machmir even on other drinks, not pour soda for you. But that is a chumra which many hold, and Rabbi holds. You don't have to follow. In other words, you can limit it to wine. Then there's another halacha which brought down to the Truma Sadeshim, and that is you can't feel each other's weight, meaning like you can't be at a seesaw together. So even though you're not touching her, she's on one side, you're on the other side, but you feel each other's weight. And Rav Abadi pointed out it's only if it's in a pronounced way. Say, for example, you're in the driver's seat of a car, and she comes into the passenger seat. So when she goes in the car is going to shake a little bit. Right? But Rav Abadi pointed out that's okay, because that's not pronounced. That's not like a seesaw. Or if you're in a rowboat or a canoe together, so that's, as Rav Abadi pointed out, that's problematic, because when you tilt to the side, then the whole thing comes up, and that's very pronounced. So so that's then also that it's also hamsnadeg is awesome. Then there's a discussion of the poskim about taking a tiyul together. So Rabbi says that if you take it to Yule, but there's other people around, so it's not so romantic, that's okay. You go to Central Park in the day with hundreds of other people, that's okay. But Rabbi pointed out, if you, even though Yichud is okay, but if you take, Rabbi pointed out, like a secluded nature trail and some romantic, and there's no one to you alone, and this, no one else is there, so that could be a problem. But just going in the park, you know, with so many other people there, that's not so romantic, and therefore that wouldn't be prohibited. Okay, so those are the more or less the restrictions when your wife is a neder. And again, these restrictions apply till she goes to the mikveh. In other words, there's no difference between the first 5 days and the last 7 days of the 12th. Bottom line, she hasn't been in the mikveh yet, then all these things apply. Now, there's another din neder. We're going to speak maybe next time we'll talk about tsamim, because we didn't speak about tsamim. Next time we have to speak about neder d'oraisa and neder d'rabbanan. We're not going to have enough time to do that now. Well, maybe just start discuss dam b'sulam now a little bit. And then next week we'll discuss tsamim. Remind me that's what we have to pick up with next week. Tsamim, stain. Okay, you remind me? Okay. Now, dam b'sulam is another interesting thing. That when a couple has intercourse at the beginning of their marriage, so a woman has a hymen, which is like a membrane. And when the man's ava penetrates the woman, so the hymen will break and it'll bleed. So she becomes a neder. Now that's not a real neder d'oraisa, because it's not coming from the uterus. Right? The hymen has nothing to do with the uterus. So really, that should be totally mutter. Right? We started the shiur off by saying that the only time a woman is a neder if the blood comes from the uterus. This is not from the uterus. In fact, a lot of times women might have like wounds, abrasions, and we send them to doctors or nurses to look inside to see if we suspecting that even though there's blood coming out of her, that doesn't make sense. It's not the time that she'd be bleeding. So sometimes women just bleed even when it's not the time they should be bleeding, and it'll be awesome. And so when we have a reason to be suspicious, so there are different women that around in different communities that check. They call a bodeket, they check, or you can go to the doctor, but then you have to make an appointment, and you know, always get it right away, but if you have a bodeket, she could check, and she could say, oh, you see that there's a scratch on the side over here, that's where the blood is coming from, it's not coming from the uterus, and therefore she would be permissible. But chymal bleeding is also not from the uterus, so really should be permissible, but chazal v'machmir, midrabanan, treat the chymal bleeding like damida. So that would mean that after the couple has intercourse, they would have to separate. When the hymen is broken, or if they had a bia gemura, etc. And you know, and that's, you know, more complications. And that could be the second time they have intercourse also. There could be more bleeding. But the Tzemach Tzedek says by the second time, you can be more makel if you have the, you know, we have to do ksomim to understand that din. But some women, Rav Moshe has a kula where he says that, see, sometimes couples have difficulty consummating their marriage for different reasons. They just don't know how to do it yet, or they don't know how to aim properly, or they don't have to. And therefore, sometimes the hymen itself is very thick, and they just can't break it. So sometimes you need to go to a doctor, and the doctor just has to take his instrument and then just pop it open. And obviously she's going to bleed. But Rav Moshe has a kula that hymen bleeding only makes a woman a nida if it's done through intercourse. But if the hymen was open not through intercourse, then she's not a nida. So that's a very big kula. That's a very big it's a question that some have, whether is it proper then just to go to the doctor and have them open up the hymen to, you know, to avoid the whole din of dam suin or not. That's a, you know, that's a whole discussion. But that's you know, that could be very, you know, very hard. You know, it's a very, you know, here the couple's finally together for the first time, and then we're gonna separate them, you know, after their consummated marriage. That's it's hard for them, but they still have to follow the halacha. But again, in other words, Be'ez Hashem, if any of you get engaged and would like to learn 101, you know, you can do, you know, that's why whenever I give chassid classes, I never give classes. I only do 101. Because the only way you can really understand it well and speak it out is in a one-on-one setting. So I, you know, Be'ez Hashem, if the right time is whenever, you know, you let me know, I'd be happy to learn with you. Okay, so Be'ez Hashem, next week we're going to continue on these zinyanim, okay? And remind me, Ariel, that we're going to start from ksamim, staining, because we didn't do that. We have to discuss the difference between nida deraisa, nida rabbanan, and other things, and vestos also. Remind me, vestos. V-E-S-T-O-S. V-E-S-T-O. Okay, but these are some basic ideas that we're saying here today. Yeah. So I'm going to tell you originally that's the next thing we should still be used to.